From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, June 4th. I'm John Myers from KQED. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, blog king from the Los Angeles Times.
Yes.
Guy with his finger on the pulse of politics.
But where's my other finger? That's the question.
This is... Well, then, now, and on to politics. There's no segue out of...
My other finger is also on the pulse of politics.
Your finger is on the... Mine's on the mute button.
I don't know where your mind is, but I know where my finger is.
Okay.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, everyone. The Friday before Election Day. Let's just keep on trucking here, as they say. So, Election Day, around the corner, Tuesday. Vote early, vote often.
Can't come soon enough.
I'm tired. I'm worn down from this here primary election.
You're bored, aren't you?
Thingy. Well, I'm not bored. But I feel like I feel like the press, collectively speaking, us and the press. No, but I would think a lot of reporters I know maybe feel like I do. We'll see if you do. I feel like I've written it all already.
And the drama seems to be gone.
Yeah, and we've talked, you know, the narrative has kind of played itself out in the primary, especially the Republican gubernatorial primary. We know where they stand, we know what's going on, we know the dynamics, and now the voters get to sort this out and we all go home.
I will say this just sort of as before we get into the substance.
Yes.
Here, is that
wait, I was going to say there's substance in this podcast?
Well, it's all relative, right? But you know, covering campaigns and covering government, the thing about covering campaigns is that there's just not a lot of meat there. I mean, it's all about narrative, and I mean, unless you're doing real investigative work, you have a couple of weeks or months to do a project, you know, investigating the background of a candidate. On the day to day, it's a lot of he said, she said,
yeah,
quite literally in the governor's race,
yeah,
and not a lot of substance. I find it very shallow. I find it not very soul satisfying,
and I think it is challenging, especially in this world. We're not doing a media analysis podcast, but it is challenging in the online 24/7 world we live in to figure out as reporters. I mean, you know, the public, you know, has the same problem, but reporters, I mean, you know, let's face it, folks, that you're listening to this, we have the same problem you do, which is how do we sift out what's a story, what's not a story, when do we cover the horse race, when do we back off and do issues. You know, like I've done some coverage about their Whitman and Poisoner's ideas on tax credits and things like that. But you can't ignore the race. You can't ignore the dynamics of the race. You know, immigration becomes this hot issue. It isn't on anybody's radar on the polls, but we all have to stop and cover whatever.
Right.
So
right.
It's tough, but we're a little tired.
But now we get into the narratives. You know,
we have different narratives come the general election.
Yes, yes.
So let's talk about some polling. And if you're one of those people who listens to the podcast between midnight and 6 a.m. normally on Fridays,
our
and
apologies.
Might I say to you, Somonex.
Get some sleep.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're in, you know.
But anyway, if you're one
Kyrgyzstan,
of those people.
And it's really 2 in the afternoon.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. And we've had an armed forces member who was in Afghanistan, actually, who couldn't listen to the podcast. He wanted a transcript. Bless his heart, I couldn't help
really?
Him.
Really? I would have. Why didn't you let me know?
Okay, well, I'll get you back to his address.
Okay.
But if you're one of those people who you're not listening to this between midnight and 6, because I am honoring the embargo of the field poll.
But not our men and women fighting overseas, apparently.
I can't help it. The field
Happy
poll.
Happy Memorial Day to you.
I will pass them on to Mark DiCamillo, the director of the field poll. Field poll is embargoed until 6 a.m., so everything I'm saying now on Thursday can't be heard unsealed until 6 a.m. Friday. And that is that Meg Whitman is killing Steve Poisoner in the poll.
That's killing.
Yeah, in political parlance.
Yes.
51-25. 51 Whitman, 25 Poisoner, 18% undecided. Now, from the metrics of the field poll, that's a substantially smaller lead than she had the last time they were in the field. But everybody else's polls have been showing her lead growing. I think, and then you've got your own tracking poll, Capitol Weekly guy, you.
Yes, wearing that hat.
But Field was out surveying voters pretty recently, and so you've got to believe these numbers are out there and they're real.
As we're waiting.
What do you guys have? Yeah,
we have. We had a 3-day track conducted Sunday, Monday, Tuesday of this week. What is that? The 31st, 1st, 30th?
Yep. I think 30th, 31st,
31st, and
1st.
Yeah. And we basically now the track is not necessarily it's a snapshot in time. Covering a 3-day window, keep in mind about a third of voters have already cast their ballots. But we showed a 30-point lead for Meg Whitman, 54-24 comparable mm-hmm. within the margin of error of the field poll. Staying with the governor's race for a minute, we show a wide lead for Meg Whitman. So this race seems to have narrowed, but the two lines never crossed, and now Whitman has now reopened her lead over Steve Poizner.
Yeah, and going back to Field's survey, which was over a longer sense of time, and I don't know how many voters you queried, but, you know.
750 Republican.
Okay, there you voters. Go. Yeah, and Field's got a pretty good sample size, too. Right. But anyway, all polls are a snapshot in time, but these are snapshots in time that were pretty current to where we are now. Yes. So, but going back and looking at Field, I mean, they found Whitman's lead in all subcategories of voters. And what I found most fascinating out of the Field poll, which just, you know, again, when the post-mortem is written on this election, and I want to be respectful to the Poizner campaign and say, and I'm not saying it's not over, the voters have got to decide, but it ain't looking good according to the polls. But when the post-mortem is written on this, you've got to wonder about the Poizner strategy. In the Field data, Whitman's favorable, unfavorable rating was 62 favorable, 24 unfavorable. So all of that barrage of the Poizner ads against Whitman's character, against her trustworthiness, her truthfulness, they don't seem to have had an impact.
Right.
62% favorable.
Is that among Republican voters?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the Republican sample. For Poizner, it was 40% favorable, 39% unfavorable. So his favorables were lower, his unfavorables were higher. I can't get back. 62% favorable for Whitman after a $28 million beating by Poizner with the ads.
Well, but one of the things, and this sort of harkens back to the email that was revealed from the Poizner campaign oh so many months ago from Whitman strategist Mike Murphy, saying basically the only thing the Poizner campaign was going to succeed in doing is softening up Meg Whitman for Jerry Brown in November. And it's interesting. I mean, only two-thirds of I don't know where that stands, you know, historically, but two-thirds of Republicans have a favorable opinion of Whitman. But polls have shown that her general election standing against Brown has taken a hit. There's been about a 10-point swing from where she was a couple of months ago. Now, the general election, it's a whole other ball of money.
I think it really is. I really think it is. In a way, I almost think, right, I mean, we're not going to start over from scratch,
right,
but a whole lot of things are going to happen. They're going to change that. But yeah.
But anyway. But the question is how much of this, you could look at it two ways. How much of this can you say, hey, look, this stuff on Whitman, all the Goldman Sachs stuff that all came out early, that's done, that's out of the way. And Whitman's campaign sort of took a punch and was able to survive and she becomes a stronger candidate. Or how much of this is going to soften her up and weaken her in November? I mean, that's, I guess, a question for, 3 months down the line?
Yeah, and I think next week we can do the full post-mortem podcast where we can try to evaluate what worked, what didn't in the campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got an itching to do some of that now, but I do want to be respectful of the voters have to say their piece.
We'll but a third of them have already cast their vote, so
yes, that's
we're respecting
true. That's true. We're respecting. For those of you who have already cast your vote, move on over to the other podcast.
Right.
No, just kidding. So those numbers look tough for the Poizner campaign. There were 18% undecided in the Field poll, but you'd have to win all those and pull back Whitman voters in the final hours. And the law of political gravity usually says you're not going to be able to do that.
Yes.
The tractor beam has sucked in, whatever. I'm thinking of a Star Wars thing there, but I couldn't quite piece it all out.
That's all right.
Senate race, you guys also dipped into in your tracking poll. What'd you find there, the Republicans?
Again, we see Carly Fiorina opening a wide lead over Tom Campbell, which was a reversal from our last poll. Our last poll, which was a full survey, was taken before the Fiorina paid media campaign really began. And she was trailing Campbell by double digits in that poll. Now we show her with a 15-point lead, 40-25. I believe Chuck DeVore had 12% of the vote. So still about 25% undecided in that poll. But again, the momentum and the movement clearly seems to be towards Fiorina away from Campbell.
You know, I mean, I'm not following that one as closely, not covering that race the whole time, and I don't know what your sense is, but, you know, trying to figure out what dynamic has changed there. I mean, you know, there's one thought out there that the cumulative effect of all of the beating on Campbell has finally taken its toll. There's another theory that Fiorina's money to be on television has boosted her numbers. Whitman, excuse me, wrong race. Campbell doesn't have the money. Campbell hasn't been on the air. I mean, he's scrambling here in the 11th hour to put a TV ad up.
But he
had pulled all of his TV ads back because he didn't have the money. So there's one narrative that says that's part of it. What do you make of
those? Yeah. I mean, I do think that when you take the Fiorina campaign together with some of the third party attacks on Campbell, I mean, and the fact that Campbell's base is not among conservative voters. I mean, Republican primary voters are older conservative voters, and I think and the fact that he has not been able to raise the money that Fiorina has. And there's a real question about whether this speaks to Campbell's ability as a fundraiser or given the new federal campaign finance laws under McCain-Feingold, where you have limits of $1,000, $2,000 for candidates to raise money, when you're faced with someone who can write a check to herself for $2.5 million, it puts you at a significant disadvantage.
And yet in the Senate race, what's still fascinating to me is that the polling data still seems to indicate, I don't know if you guys asked this question or not, I can't remember which poll I've read at this point, but that the data still seems to indicate that Campbell, according to the polls, according to the survey, is still the stronger candidate against Boxer in November, and yet Republicans are not choosing him. Contrast that with the field poll, which I neglected to put this in there, that the Republican voters believe Whitman is the strongest candidate against Brown and are voting for her. Now, they're not apples to apples. I mean, they're different campaigns. I can't completely draw that analysis. But I am fascinated that Republican voters in one race have an opinion here, and in another race have another opinion that they're kind of playing the numbers differently.
They seem to be practical. Well, yeah. I think you have to be careful making that comparison because I think, you know, Campbell has a record on issues that fly in the face of Republican orthodoxy, you know, and unlike Whitman. So I don't think there's anything that Whitman has in her record that would be terribly offensive to core Republican voters per se, you know. We may see that. I mean, I know Poisner camp would disagree, but nonetheless.
Go ahead.
I mean, whether about it was supporting Barbara Boxer 10 years ago or whatever it is, you know, saying that she had supported amnesty once, although Whitman says she doesn't. But Campbell has a record on taxes and his association with Governor Schwarzenegger and some of the anti-tax groups who've come out against Campbell. He supports gay marriage. He's very liberal on social issues, more so than the Republican base in this state. And so I think it's Campbell's record that really sort of trumps any kind of electability questions. But I think outsiders have an advantage. We saw it with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who never had to go through a primary process, or at least not initially, but that Republicans were willing to vote for him over Tom McClintock because they were willing to sort of take a flyer on him on economic issues.
Well, and they don't have a record. They don't have a record, and Fiorina is in that same thing. She doesn't have a political record.
Right.
Campbell has a very long political record. But back to the fundraising for a minute. I haven't poured through those records because they're federal records. Well, they're federal. Yeah, they're federal records. It's a different system. We could complain about tracking that money, but that's a different podcast.
Yes.
But I am surprised, given that we continue to hear that Campbell has. Again, they probably would take issue if I said he struggled to raise money, but he has not raised voluminous amounts of money in this race, at least comparative to, although Fiorina is putting in a lot of her own money.
Right.
But my larger point is that Campbell does have a very close relationship with the most prolific Republican fundraiser in California history, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Meg Whitman.
Well, you know, that's self-funding, yeah. But you know, I am somewhat surprised that more of the Schwarzenegger donor base maybe didn't reach out to help Campbell, who is a Republican in the Arnold Schwarzenegger mold. Now, one of the fascinating parts is that the restrictions, the limitations, as you and I know, on federal contributions are much lower. The threshold is much lower than in state races, which I think there is an interesting commentary on how much money flows into California politics versus national politics.
Right.
But I'm still somewhat surprised. I mean, you know, and you know, Arnold could not get out and campaign for Campbell. That would be a little radioactive at this point with the way Schwarzenegger is with Republicans. But you would think there'd be things behind the scenes that he could do. I mean, this is a guy who again, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but you know what I mean? Is in the mold of the Schwarzenegger element of Republican politics.
But I think you hit on it. I mean, for governor, you can write a $32,000 check. For U.S. Senate, you can write a $2,000 check. I mean, yep. that's a big difference. And so,
of course, it could have been an independent expenditure on his behalf, given the new Supreme Court ruling.
Right,
but still,
right. But if you sort of accept on its face that Campbell is leaving $30,000 on the table per donor, I mean, in a core group of, I don't know, 20 to 50 donors, I mean, that's, you know, $30,000 a pop. That's real money. That's money that Schwartz. Now, we had heard, I mean, I'm sure you, like I, heard all these reports that Whitman had opened up her fundraising, donor base to Campbell, and that Campbell even hired one of Whitman's fundraisers to work for his campaign. He didn't do badly, but I think that the federal laws do really limit and do put you at a disadvantage when you're running against someone who can at least partially self-finance.
And Fiorina certainly did. She dumped a respectable amount of her own money, million dollars into her own campaign. Well, we'll see where that one's going to go. That one's going to get a lot of national attention. Boxer fighting back. Boxer was seen voting early this week. Mm-hmm. In her new home in Riverside County. I always forget that she lives down in
the desert.
In the desert now instead of Marin, which is where she was from. But
yes.
I'll never get that straight.
That's okay.
So as we come to Election Day, we've got a lot of other races. I had somebody email in who listens to the podcast who said maybe we should have gone through all the propositions and explained them. I think he's right on a policy level, but I think that's awfully hard to do.
Tell you what, we'll discuss the ones that pass. How about that?
but there are, I mean, let's just talk about the measures for a moment. I mean, it was certainly in money. I mean, we've seen a tremendous amount of money on two of them, largely by two entities.
Yes.
PG&E has opened, I was going to say PG&E's wallet, but it's probably the wallet of its investors who own the utility.
That translation, everybody who pays their bill.
It could be ratepayers too. Yes. But opened their coffers to, I don't even know where that number is. I shouldn't have brought it up.
I believe it was 60. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's a high number there.
See, in 60 million.
Yeah. Of
$60.
Right. To support Prop 16. Which would change the entire system of how local communities could enter into these utility agreements or cooperative agreements.
Make it harder for people to leave PG&E.
Yes, exactly. This is something that, you know, PG&E says it's good for citizens and their taxpayer dollars.
Right.
But let's face it, it's also good business for PG&E.
Right.
And then Prop 17, Mercury Insurance, who put another $1 million in at the end of this week, they are somewhere in the... Boy, they're in the real high numbers there. I can't quite remember now. Again, I should have done all of my homework before I came in.
This is really illuminating
podcast. But it's another one where Mercury is the single sole donor to Prop 17, right, which would change the way auto insurance rates are offered to particular drivers. Apparently, it could hurt some. It could help some. Again, I apologize to the listener who wanted a long policy
there
going on here.
How is that?
I think this
some
is
people
this
win,
is fatigue.
Some
this
lose.
Is fatigue from election cycle. It's fatigue from election cycle. So those two huge money there. Nothing else big money in the ballot measure campaigns. Probably the next one that has money would be Prop 14, which was the Schwarzenegger fundraising effort.
Yes.
To pass Prop 14. I did a couple of stories. Not about the campaign, but about the larger issue of that on the California Report this week. And I tell you, I mean, 14, you know, the polls say Prop 14 is going to pass.
Yep. But will it matter?
But no one really knows how or if it will change the electoral system and in what ways it will change the electoral system. And I find that interesting because it really is a vote against party politics. Mm-hmm. When you strip down all the things that it does, open primary, everybody gets to vote on every candidate, top two vote-getters go to November, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. It is a vote against party politics. And, you know, in an angry electorate, that probably has some appeal. The parties don't like it, and the reason they don't like it is because it is a vote toward relegating parties to another tier below any voters, and frankly, independent voters. I think Prop 14 is written with independent voters in mind.
It is.
The person who actually wrote Prop 14 is Steve Peace. Former state senator, a Democratic state senator who now is the co-chair of the California Independent Voter Network. He wrote a measure in 2008 that was the template of 14, and everybody called him that night when they needed something in the middle of the budget debate, and they've got Prop 14. Okay. And he is a firm believer that the political parties are killing the political process.
Right.
And so there you have it. So I think that one's going to be fascinating.
Yeah. And there was a really interesting story in the Contra Costa Times over the weekend that the Republican Party is already looking for ways to get around the system should it pass, moving to a caucus system to select essentially the proverbial smoke-filled room, right, to select their candidates.
Where, therefore, they wouldn't have three candidates on a ballot who would split the vote and allow a Democrat to move to November or something like that.
Right, right.
But I think even then it's going to be very hard for the parties to completely rework that process. They're going to find their way around. I think the real groups, the real thing that voters are going to be maybe surprised about if you talk to the experts is that campaigns are going to cost more than they did. And you certainly can see that if you look at some of the legislative races
let me finish my thought and then you can debunk it.
Right. But if you look at some of the legislative races now that are full of independent expenditure money, where they are two candidates of the same party beating each other about the head, there are several districts around the state. One you've talked about a lot, a state Senate race, but there are a few assembly district races as well. I went to cover one down in the Bay Area.
20th or 21st?
20th in Fremont, in the Fremont, Newark, Alameda County area. Yep. Those two candidates under Prop 14 would go on to November. Those independent expenditure groups, trial lawyers, environmentalists, nurses, whoever, would have to spend even more money and would probably spend more money then again in the general election to continue this fight, mailers, radio ads, et cetera. I don't subscribe to something that's necessarily horrible, I mean, but it is a reality that you do continue the fight among some candidates that would end in the primary. Debunk it, Anthony.
No, I find that argument borderline offensive. Because
I don't know that it's an argument, but go ahead.
Well, no. I mean, well, it's an argument against the open primary system. Not that you're making, but people use this argument that, hey, it's just going to make campaigns more expensive. Well, guess what? That's because they're going to be competitive. God forbid we have a competitive race in the fall in this state.
I'm not taking it from that side. I just simply make the point voters tend to have a distaste for high-priced campaigns, and they say they have a distaste for negative politics. I know it works.
Well, how about a taste for some competitive elections and having voters actually have a say in the fall? I mean, it will probably raise the cost of campaigns, but again, that's because you're going to have competitive races in places where, in that race in the 20th, was it Garrett Yee running against
Bob Wykowski?
Imagine how different that race would look.
Two Democrats.
Imagine how different that race would look if Republicans were eligible to vote between those two candidates. It would fundamentally alter the political landscape there.
Yeah.
So,
and there are races. People say that statewide races there may not be a big shift, and I think that's right. But I'll tell you a race right now that we've already talked about: the U.S. Senate. Can you picture Tom Campbell's ability to make it to November?
Sure.
If he can appeal to Democrats and independents who may be more moderately aligned, Fiorina would have a much harder road to hoe.
Now, didn't this happen to Campbell before? Didn't we pass an open primary system shortly after he lost a U.S. Senate primary to a more conservative candidate, right, with Prop 208 passing the 92 election? When was 208 passed? 96?
Yeah, 96.
He lost in 92. Anyway, history repeating itself.
Yeah, but I would just say that there's a race that you could see that happen. Imagine, too, the governor's race.
Right.
Where Brown, Whitman, Poizner, and the cast of many others would all compete on one ballot. Only two of them would go to November. It might still be Brown and Whitman, but who knows? That's a very interesting three-way competition between those three well-known candidates. Anyway, I'm not one of those people who says it's going to be horrible. I don't think it's going to be great. I do think that voters just need to have tempered expectations of the change because
this
parts of the political system
will everything.
Yeah, parts
and
of
make
the political
my floors
system,
shine.
Parts of the political system will continue. They will not go away.
And my reverse mortgage will disappear.
Yeah. So and then all those legislative races we've got to watch next week. So what are you going to be watching for come election night? What are your big messages to our loyal podcast audience here for next week?
Get plenty of bottled water and dried goods.
It's survival, survival stuff, just in case.
No, I think you know, obviously the birth of the Jerry Brown campaign is something that we're interesting to see. Typically, the Meg Whitman pivot into a general election candidate, but also
assuming she wins, Poizner campaign would say. Go ahead.
Well, and also the positioning of the Republican Party that if Whitman and Fiorina hold on, you're going to have two women at the top of the ticket, right? And then, and as lieutenant governor, and then if Abel Maldonado holds on against Sam Onestad.
Well, let's do some of that in the postmortem next week. But
right.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things I'll be looking at, and we can discuss that next week.
Yeah. Do you think it's going to be a late night? I don't have the sense it's going to be a late night.
Nope.
I think we'll kind of know what's going on relatively soon.
Like yesterday.
Want to make any predictions?
Haven't I already?
Yes,
haven't
you
I
have.
Done
you
quite
have,
enough?
You have
I do
already.
Think I do think Prop 14 will pass, and I think everything else goes down.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the conventional wisdom is that when the voters are confused, they tend to vote no.
Yeah.
And I think there is some confusion about 16 and 17. The public financing of campaigns, the Prop 15 one is an interesting one, very under the radar.
Right.
So
I
could see that again in an angry electorate
too.
Pass.
Right.
Prop 13 will not go down. That's the seismic retrofit proposal,
right,
which
right.
we all have completely forgotten about because nobody seems to be thinking about it.
Right.
But anyway.
Lieutenant Governor, I think it's Abel Maldonado against Gavin Newsom.
Yep. I would probably predict those as well.
Let's see. Attorney General. You want to call that one?
No, I don't want to call it, though. I mean, you know, it's going to be we're on both sides, Democratic and Republican sides.
Yeah.
I mean, the conventional wisdom is Steve Cooley wins the Republican nomination, Kamala Harris wins the Democratic nomination.
Right.
That's conventional wisdom. It's been proven wrong. I don't want to be the Dewey defeats Truman guy with the newspaper on Wednesday morning. But those are all very interesting races, again, where you split the vote out a lot of different ways.
And I do think if you look at the potential matchups for November, and this is something we'll talk more about next week.
But
this,
you can't help yourself, can
no,
you?
No, but this could be the year that Republicans, you know, gain some traction and maybe win a couple in California in November.
And with that, we'll see where we are.
To be continued.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll try to figure out when to do the post-election podcast. Maybe we won't wait. Well,
I'll be in L.A. Tuesday night.
Yeah, so will I. Maybe we'll wait till Friday. We got to rest up a little bit.
Friday?
Well, you know, it comes out on Friday.
Maybe. Oh, right.
Yeah,
maybe
we'll
Wednesday.
See. We'll check our calendars.
Maybe we'll go early.
Stay tuned, podcast fans.
Okay.
You can always check kqed.org/capitalnotes for
Capital with an A.
An update. Capital with an A. Thank you.
Unlike Capital Weekly at capitalweekly.net.
With an O.
Capital with an O.
And now that our plugs are done, I'm John Myers from KQED. That is Anthony York from Capital Weekly. See you next time.